Hi. Thanks for being here. What an amazing job Coley's done. I'm stunned, hasn't he? First of all, just before I get started, I just want to get a little sample. Who in the audience consider themselves to be designers, primarily? Okay, and developers? Front end? Okay. Are there any neuroscientists here today? Is that a hand? No, okay, you're joking. Good. The reason I ask is because this talk's got a little bit of neuroscience in it, and it's a subject that's completely fascinated me. I'll tell you a little story about how it came about. Is I was sitting in my garden with a colleague of mine, Alan Colville. And Alan, being the UX designer that he is interested in all sorts of weird esoteric psychology stuff and neuroscience. And he dropped this little seed about a very ancient part of the brain with me. And he said that this part of the brain has no language. And that fascinated me. So I thought that was really cool. And this is the reason I'm talking about today. And I'm hoping you guys are going to think this is pretty cool too. This talk is dedicated to Alan. A couple of days ago, a truck knocked him off his bike coming into work in Bristol. He'd be here today, but he's very seriously injured. So when you see the video, Al, cheers, mate. And we just want to wish you all the best. So, just in case you didn't know anything about me at all, that's me at the top, believe it or not. I work with a group of other guys, some of which are here. John Gibbons is here, Chris Shuffert's here, Alan was supposed to be here, and another guy called Andre in San Francisco. Together we're a co-op, we run a co-op called Analog, and we are currently not doing any client work. We're actually just building an app called Mapalong, and I was lucky enough with Rich Rutter to co-found FontDeck, which has been really well looked after that, because I've done very little work. Clear Left and OmniTI have done all the work. I still like Toblerone. I used to have hair. I really wish I had it back. And I've got a couple of boys who look amazingly like me, apparently, or I can't see it. So let's get to it. Language. Some of you may know or may have heard or seen me write something. I love typography, and as part of that, I love language. I love words. I find them amazing. I don't use them as well as I want to. But just to sort of go back a little bit to what Dan Rubin was talking about earlier today, I find them incredibly important. I mean, the root of the word is interesting to me. Latin, lingua. I'm reading my notes just so I don't mess this up. There are about 3,000, apparently, to 6,000 spoken languages in the world today, which is pretty amazing. And there are a lot of natural languages that can be based on visual stimuli, like sign language, for example. And I would say that actually design is something of a natural language as well, because design is based on, primarily at least, visual stimuli. So earlier Dan said that language matters. He said that the absence of words have power. And that's a portion of what this talk today is about. The picture there that I chose is taken from the 20th floor, an apartment owned by someone called Jesse Arrington and Crichton, who work in the studio in Brooklyn, in Dumbo, which is where this is taken. And the reason I chose the picture is because languages to develop structures and conventions for us to understand the world. And New York's fascinating, isn't it? Because if you ever go there, it's absolute carnage. You know, Brooklyn's carnage. You know, there's all this stuff going on, all this input. But fundamentally, it's based on a kind of weird grid. So there's structure there. There's convention underlying it. So, although we have all these words, it's amazing how many times we get stuck for words. We're lost for words. We're speechless. We're dumbfounded. You guys have probably all had this at some point in your life. Something's happened, or you've seen something, and you've probably just gone like, what? Or if you're American, what the fuck? And that's all you can say in that moment. You don't have any words to express this feeling that seeing this thing or experiencing this thing has actually brought out in you. Now, the reason that I find that really interesting is because we're dealing here with gut reactions and instincts, and they happen in a split second. They happen so quickly that we don't even realize they're happening. And so if they're happening to us, they're also happening to our audience and the audience of the sites that we create. So how many people in the room do client work primarily? Okay, that's really interesting. So when you're doing client work, oftentimes what you're trying to do is reach past the client to the audience to try and understand who these people are and try and reach out to them. So understanding why we get lost to words and why we sometimes speechless and dumbfounded and why we have reactions to things that we recognize as being true without the language to describe them is kind of, I think, an important part of that, of how you can communicate information to people using the medium that we work on today in the web. This is, to me, a picture that communicates a lot. You guys might have heard this story. There's a festival in Cambodia, in Phnom Penh, and everyone's out having a great time, and suddenly, for unknown reasons, there's a panic, a stampede. And this is the Rainbow Bridge, which people try to cross, getting away from an island, to get away from this panic, this crush. And hundreds of people died. Now, knowing that backstory, without the backstory, you see the image, and it's a bit like, well, I'm not really sure what that is. It's like loads of stuff on a bridge. Obviously, something's happened. But as soon as you know the backstory, to me anyway, I have this visceral reaction, this kind of like, it almost brought me to tears, in all honesty, because of the aftermath, what's left behind, that a picture can tell without any words, really, just by knowing something of a story previously. Now this, I should credit this as well, because I'm not sure if the Guardian are quite cool with me using it. So it's from Guardian Eyewitness, and it's taken by a guy called Tang Chin Sophie on behalf of AFP. This next picture I'm going to show you doesn't need any words. It doesn't need any backstory, and it's pretty, I was really struggling with myself. Do I include this or not? So I'm just going to show you. Wow. That's pretty intense, isn't it? This is New Delhi. It's a Muslim festival. And everything about this picture, when I first saw it, completely just, I didn't know what it was. I didn't have any notes. It just completely blew me away. I had this reaction to it. And I'm sure some of you probably are kind of processing that right now. So our brain has this amazing ability to fill in gaps where there is no language, fill in gaps between what we're feeling and what we think it might be, and all this kind of input we're getting, try and make sense of it. Now, sometimes you just don't need language at all. WALL-E, you've probably all seen it. Has everyone seen it? Anybody not seen WALL-E? Okay, awesome. Okay. I have two boys, as you know, so I get to watch all the kids' films, the really, really bad ones and the really, really good ones. And the thing about WALL-E that struck me is that WALL-E takes 22 minutes to build up the courage to talk to Eva. Wow, that dude is like, you know, he's in love, isn't he? 22 minutes he takes in the film. So that's a big chunk. But actually, those 22 minutes flew by for me. They just skimmed by. I didn't even notice that he wasn't talking. I was so engaged with what was going on before my eyes about his body language, his kind of putting the block on another block, and wow, look what he made, these amazing kind of structures. 22 minutes. So as some of you may know, I love type, I love typography. And so we have these emotional reactions to pictures, but we also have emotional reactions to really simple forms. So this is Bello by Underwear, which is quite possibly the greatest type foundry name. Does anybody know what this word says in the audience? Don't shout it out if you do, apart from Chris. Chris, be quiet. Yeah, I told him before. But this typeface, Bello, isn't it lovely? It's warm, it's fun, it's, you know, it's got this great energy, it's fluid, it screams out friendly and lovely, except the word says hate. So you have an emotional reaction to form, you have an impression about form that's not supported necessarily by the actual meaning of the words themselves surrounding it. And again, another typeface, Graveblade by Typodermic. I mean, this typeface to me just... it just screams slash metal on crack, you know. It's angular, it's aggressive, it's sharp, it's deadly. You could cut yourself on it. But the word is love. Again, just a demonstration. So we have these emotional reactions to forms, typefaces, all the time. And actually, a lot of this stuff is going on without us really even realizing it. We have emotional reactions too to color. Oops. Okay, color. Has anybody been here to the Pantone Hotel in Brussels? I didn't even know there was a Pantone Hotel, to be honest with you. It's pretty amazing. I was just doing some research and I was like, no way, Pantone Hotel. Gotta go and stay there, don't care how much it costs. Wait, hold on a second, dude, chill out. This hotel is basically just white with Pantone colors and they're all labeled. You know, it's like almost like an education, isn't it? If you pay to go to university, they should just send you there for like, I don't know, a month, two, and then you can just go and learn Pantone colors and design. But the thing that fascinates me is about color is that we have no words for color, really. We just make them up. So in HTML, originally, HTML 4.0.1, there's 16 colors, named colors, that is, that you might have used at one point or another. In CSS 3, which uses the SVG1 color names group, if you like, I think there's like 78, and maybe a few alphas and sort of weird grays in there as well. So there's only 78 named colors. But in a 32-bit color display, which is what MacBook Pros have, there are, let me get this right, 4.2 billion distinct colors with some non-color elements like alpha channels again. 4.2 billion. Now, the reason that's amazing is not because it's massive, which it is. It's that actually, according to research that I've read, human beings can only detect about 10 million colors. So I've got I don't know why there's another sort of 3 billion odd extra colors in there. But the interesting thing to me about color is we can have emotional reactions to color straight away, depending on the mood that we're in, the context we find ourselves in. And we don't have the language sometimes to describe them. You must have all sat in rooms at some point where someone said, I'm not sure about that reddy orange, that kind of corky, muted gray. I mean, we're trying desperately to describe what this color is, but it's not defined. And you go and look at all the different color specs and they all give them different names. I mean, buttermilk is a great example in HTML. What color is buttermilk? I've got no idea. I don't think I've even ever had buttermilk. I think it goes in posh food, and sometimes you see it on menus, trying to get you to get a dish, but I don't really know what it is. So we have these reactions to color as well. And then we have reactions to music as well, just as an example. This is a book about Blue Note Records. Does everyone know Blue Note? Have you guys all heard of Reed Miles, the designer who designed Blue Note's iconic covers for all those years? If you've not heard of this guy, I really highly recommend you go find out. He's one of my all-time design heroes. For 11 years, from about, I think it was around about 1956, he designed 500 Blue Note covers, which would just blow your head off. He had a limited color palette, limited typographic palette. He had amazing photos from a guy who actually owned Blue Note at the time, Francis Wolff. But the most important thing about this for me is that Reed Miles did not like jazz. He didn't like jazz. He loved classical music. Jazz was just some aberration stuff to him. I don't think he hated it, but he just wasn't into it. So how do you go from, as a designer, not liking the subject matter you're designing for, to producing brilliance? Well, what actually happened is that Alfred Lion, who was one of the chiefs of Blue Note, Alfred Lion would sit down with him and say, this is the intention behind this music. This is the flavor of it. He would give him that verbally. He would go away and put together a cover. He would not even listen to it. But he would nail it, and they're iconic and beautiful. So the point, though, is that you wrap all this stuff about color and type into design somehow, and somehow you can come out with amazingly evocative visual images. And music itself, as we all know, is amazingly emotional, evocative. The songs we've all got, I'm sure every single person in this room has got a song that is from their youth, from when they met a certain important partner, when they split up with them, and then when they got back together again. Or for all these stories in our lives, we usually have a musical soundtrack. And music is one of those things that hits us, doesn't it? We always say, it gets you right here. Sorry, that's the mic. Gets you in the mic. So again, emotional reaction to stuff. So why? This is what I wanted to know. I wanted to know why. So when Alan sat down in my garden and told me about this part of the brain that doesn't have language, I kind of made this leap of faith connection and decided to go and talk to neuroscientists. It was much easier than it sounds because my neighbors are professors at university and they've got friends and I just talked to those guys. And this is what they told me. In the brain, the oldest part of the brain is called the limbic system, and this is the lizard brain. The limbic system is right in the middle. The outside is all new. That's our language bit. That's our modern human bit. But in the right in the middle is the limbic system. And as part of the limbic system, you've got these two little almond-shaped, they're not actually blue, just to be clear, but these two little almond-shaped nodes called the amygdala. And the amygdala is the seat of our emotions, the seat of all of our emotions, pretty much. In fact, neuroscientists say they've stimulated the amygdala and got all sorts of weird reactions out of people, like impromptu emotional reactions. Now, the reason that this is important to us as designers is because the amygdala is also what gives us our immediate reactions and also makes us kind of jump away from something if someone gets in our personal space. Now, Seth Godin has written about this. Has anybody read any stuff that Seth Godin's written about this? Okay, some few of you have. And what he's saying is we should kill the lizard brain, because the lizard brain is like gets in our way. It stops us from being as efficient as we want to because we're not in the mood that day. You know, these emotions are unhealthy. I'm sorry, Seth, if you ever see this, but I think that's wrong. I think we should embrace the amygdala. I think this thing is really good. It's what actually makes us human. We just need to understand it a little bit better. So I talked to a neuroscientist, and this is what she told me. Dr. Masvita Chirimuta, she said, although there is no absolute separation between language and emotion, there will still be countless instances where you have emotional responses without verbal input or linguistic cognition. Without verbal input or linguistic cognition. So in general, language is not necessary for emotion. Wow, okay. I thought that was pretty cool. This is Eugene Getoff. He's a studio mate of mine. His picture's taken at the airport after he spent about 6 days hard drinking at Brooklyn Beta. And he's quite possibly the happiest man alive at this point. Adam Robertson, another studio mate who's also here, took this picture at Newark Airport. The reason I'm showing it is because, one, I love this photo of Hughes. It just sums him up for me. But two, we can detect a human face in 40 milliseconds. Now, that means I could flash you a human face, and you would never even know that you've seen it. And this is the crunch. And physiologically, we would have a physiological change in our bodies when that face had been flashed at us, even though we hadn't consciously seen it. That kind of blew me away. Kind of scary too, because, you know, you could flash loads of faces at me and I could be freaking out and, you know, we could do it on websites, you know what I mean? Now we've got all these fancy effects that Elliot was talking about. But we can recognize a human face inside of 40 milliseconds and have an emotional reaction to it. So that means that when we're working with size, when we're working in design, you know, understanding these things, these reactions that our own bodies have can be really helpful to us in understanding why certain people have certain reactions or who we're designing for and what we're trying to say to them and how we're trying to reach them. So how many designers in here, just before I move on to the next slide, how many designers in here feel like they somehow just pull this stuff together out of nowhere? Like they think about design, you do go through a process maybe a little bit, and you know, you do some planning and sketching and thinking, but somehow this material comes together and out of it you reach this eureka moment where you go, actually, that's pretty good. That's all right. I think that's good. How many of you have ever had that experience? Wow, look at that. A bunch. Phew, thank God it's not just me. Okay. So when we're doing that, although we want process and we want these rules to sort of guide us and give us something to fall back on, fundamentally, this creative process you're going through is almost like a kind of instinctual thing, right? You know, all these influences and inputs, and instinctually, usually what happens is you instinctually go around the wrong track and completely mess it up and look at it and just go, oh, that's absolutely terrible, and then start again and somehow reach the right answer. At least that's how I usually work. So I will go with Bruce Lee on this. I'm just saying, if I had a choice between Seth Godin and Bruce Lee, Bruce is going to have it all the time. And I'd quite like to see that battle. Bruce said in Enter the dragon. He's smacking a student around the head to try and obviously somehow encourage him to learn this lesson. And he says, I'm not going to do the accent. He said, don't think, feel. It's like a finger pointing at the moon. Don't look at the finger or you will miss all the heavenly glory. And I love this. It kind of sums up my feelings about our emotions and the amygdala and this kind of instinctual thing that we do so beautifully as human beings. So, I'm going to be Bruce Lee in this argument. This is a book bought for me by a colleague for a Christmas present, John Gibbons, who's around somewhere, hopefully floating around. This is our lingua. This is our language. This is our tongue, in a way. You know, symbols and icons and metaphors and motifs and all these things that we do. So we pull together color, we pull together type, we pull together form, and somehow instinctually we convey a message, hopefully clearly, lucidly, hopefully elegantly and beautifully, you know, using almost our own language, working on the web. When he bought me this book, he kind of grabbed it off my Amazon wish list or something and said, you know, I don't know if this is crap, but you can have it. And you should update your wish list because there's loads of stuff on there I know you've got. But when I saw it, I was kind of flipping through it. And if you get a copy, it's really interesting. Looking at all the different symbols that different designers have created for different languages and different cultures. That's just a bit for me. It's just flipping through that and seeing all these common kind of threads that run through all these very different sets of symbols. So just to recap ever so slightly, I think we should be designing for the lizard brain. I think we should understand the lizard brain, and I think we should accommodate it. I don't think we should concentrate on that. I think design galleries for the web, say, for example, they almost exclusively concentrate on that. Do you guys all know Command Shift 3? The site? You ever visited it? Who knows it? Okay, Command Shift 3 is basically like hot or not for web design. Right? It's kind of one of those ideas you have when you're drunk with a bunch of friends, right, late at night. But these guys were drunk with a bunch of friends late at night, and then they went out and built Command Shift 3. And it presents you with two screenshots, and you have split-second choice to decide which one you like best. Now, some of the choices are way too easy. But what it does is it reduces the quality of design down to a measure of the emotional reaction that we have. So I'm not a fan of galleries at all, because that's not what we do. We don't design pretty pictures that affect the emotional part of the brain in a split second, and that's all that we do, and that's the value in our work. That is not it, really, at all, as far as I'm concerned. But that's not to say it's not really nice to sometimes do work like that. Do you know Lost World's Fairs? Okay. So I think probably most of you have seen it, or if you haven't, you should really go check it out. Jason Santamaria and friends. This is Frank Chimero. Chimero's Lost World Fairs. Basically did a demo site with three different designs, all to basically promote IE's support of type on the web in the new version. It's great. The thing for me is that the interaction on this site is fantastic, and I know most of you probably who've been there will know it. You know, there's this little guy, he goes down a tunnel, and the site scrolls up above him, and that's wonderful. But before I even moved my mouse, I just love seeing this as a piece of emotional design. Just captured me. Now, this is the interesting bit, though, for me. I went and read what Frank had written about his own design, and he said, I mean, tongue-in-cheek, I think. It was supposed to be some kind of mid-century Las Vegas Johnny Quest-inspired journey to the bubble city at the bottom of the city. I've got no idea what that means. I can kind of get the Las Vegas thing, you know, but what it said to me is that how we've got cultural references here, we know, but how we reach as designers to try and describe our own work that we probably just produced, you know, in a moment of sort of inspiration. Yes, we've given a theme, we've got a brief of some kind, but we've reached it in a moment of inspiration with loads of influences we couldn't probably qualify. And then we've got to go back and start writing about it and try and describe this. And it's a bit like menus, and we come out with all sorts of mad nonsense. I think the people who exemplify the lack of language to describe something is probably people who write about food. fruity, aromatic, velvety. It's wine, dude. It tastes really good. Or as my friend Chris says, I don't care what you say, it's just delicious. But we're trying to reach with these words to try and make it somehow more delicious or qualify how delicious it is. I just loved it just by seeing it. It was interesting to read what Frank had to say. But, you know, so there is a place for designing for emotion only, for designing just for that first emotional reaction that we have. Because we're not going to, I'm not going to go visit this site every week and really enjoy it. It's not going to become part of my life, but I really enjoyed it as a piece of work on its own right for that moment. The same with Jason Santamaria's version as well. You know, Jason's here, you know, he's gone and done the same sort of thing. He's just wowed me straight out of the gate. This is all web type. I mean, great. I've been waiting for this for like 10 years. And, you know, here we go, web type. Again, wowed me. But it's designed to have that immediate impact that I'm talking about as regards to the amygdala and how we think. Now, Jason said about this design, he said, sometime in the not-too-distant future with a retro-future style, again, I'm not really sure what that means. Not too distant future with a retro future style. Again, reaching for something that's just good in its own right. There's nothing wrong with that, by the way, but it's just interesting to observe. So those are two examples of sites that are kind of designed to reach the amygdala and reach our emotions, get us a reaction. But as a designer working on the web, I think, I'm much more interested in a relationship that I have with pieces of work over the long term. You know, there are certain sites that have probably been friends of mine and have probably been friends of yours for the best part of 5 more years, easily. But I've used them constantly. They become a part of my life. They're a way that I tell my story and my friends tell their stories to me. And they are incredibly useful. They have utility more than they have immediate emotional impact. And one of those is Flickr. You know, I mean, it's a really easy example to use, but I use it because it's a genuine site that's been with me for a long, long time. And I think as designers, we have to understand the amygdala and understand this designing for emotion. Have you ever, guys, ever read Don Norman's book on this? Have you ever read any Don Norman about this? Anybody? Okay, so Don Norman gives this example of teapots, that you can have this amazingly beautiful teapot, and every time you pour it, the spout just pisses tea everywhere. It doesn't go in a cup, it goes down the pot. Or, you know. So it's a beautiful thing, but fundamentally it's not got utility. Flickr, when it first arrived, it was just very rational as a design for me and just seemed to fit its purpose. I'm not going to say it's beautiful, but to me it has a beauty through its utility, and I'll continue to use it because it serves me well like that. So although things, beauty is something to aspire to, there's different versions of it. There's the quick, immediate emotional reaction, and there's a long-term reaction, there's appreciation of this. Now, delicious is a different example. I personally hate the new delicious design. I mean, you know the furore the last month or so about is delicious going to close and we should all move to Pinboard? Well, you know, I've got both accounts, but to me, I never actually visit delicious. Has anybody, who's got delicious accounts? Who actually visits delicious regularly? Was that 2 people? Okay, so that's a lot of people who've got them and 2 people who visit regularly. Now this to me is a new kind of design challenge for us working on the web. Designing the site that people don't visit. Designing the experience around that site, if you like. Because my experience of Delicious is, I bookmark stuff, they keep it safe, and I get it out when I want. A long time ago on Twitter, John Hicks, who's somewhere around, where are you, John? There he is. John was talking about Evernote, I think, on Twitter. And he said, he hashtagged it. He was trying to get his data out of Evernote to do all the stuff with it. And he hashtagged it, my data, not yours. I tell you what, that has stuck with me. Because this is a design principle, right? It's not an open source principle. It's not kind of any kind of principle. It's a design principle that the data insights like Delicious is actually our data. It's my data, and I want to be able to get it out. And that's exactly what I do with Delicious. I just put it in, I don't go to the site, I get it out again, I do stuff with it. Now, that's not visual design, is it? But it is design. And that's the sort of thing that we have to be thinking about. And for me personally, I see a lot of very well-executed visual design on the web, but the whole experience around that, all the touch points around this service or whatever it is, they haven't really been designed. So in some parts, it's lovely, and then you try and use it, and it's crap. Or it's mostly good, except sometimes it fails in the last 20%. That's really important to me. like being able to get my data out, like being able to do all the stuff with it. Oh, just lost my signal. Hold on one sec. Okay. So we have this new era where we're trying to design for all this data. We want to design for an emotional reaction. We want things to be beautiful and useful and have utility in the long term. But then we've got this sort of new thing where all we're doing is generating data, managing it on other people's sites, and then pulling it into other places and doing interesting stuff with it. A couple of years ago, we built a site for a designer in residence at the time. She was designer in residence, Denna was, at the Royal College of Art. And she consults with architects. The thing is, Denna was a friend. She didn't have a lot of money. So we needed to do this simply and quickly. But she did have a Tumblr account. She did have a Flickr account. She did have a Delicious account. She did have a Twitter account. She was already generating all the content she needed for her site elsewhere. So all we did is we just plugged it all into Denna Jones on her site. And then this is where the design bit came in. We made it easy for her to update her stuff and refresh the site itself and try to mold all these parts into something that made sense on its own using all these bits of data. Okay, and it still needs to have some kind of emotional reaction. But to me, it was a genuine one. We didn't use stock photography. We used Denna's own photography. There was a genuine kind of connection here between this site with all this data she generated around the web and hopefully the people who are coming to visit it. I'm not saying it's the best design in the world or anything like that, but I really enjoyed this process of linking all these things together that now confront us on the web. So we design for emotion, and we design for utility. And at the moment, I'm working on a project. This is Mapalong that we're working on at the moment. Oh, kind of. That's probably slightly better. Mapalong's just one big map. You know, there's not a canvas here I get to paint on as a designer and play with and put all sorts of different stuff into it. It's one big map for mapping all of the data we generate elsewhere and making sort of visual sense out of it. And as a designer, I'm kind of confronted by this challenge. Do I satisfy my aesthetic urges and make it as pretty as possible? Or do I design for utility? So in this instance, I'm designing for utility. And the point about Mapalong is it uses Arial. Now, I'm a typographer. I'm not a fan of Arial. It's not my favorite thing, but it works. It's there. It's omnipresent, as Mark was talking about. You know, you fit the content to the device. I know if I use Arial, I'm going to cover a vast array of the people who I want to use Mapalong eventually. And also, I know because of the geometry of Arial that the fallback fonts and other different mobile devices is going to fall back pretty nicely. So I'm designing for utility. I'm designing, hopefully, so that Mapalong becomes people's friends, like Flickr's my friend, over a long time, even if you don't visit the site very often. So just to finish up, this is a saying from a tailor that I met once upon a time. And he said, the best shirts are the ones that look great from a distance, but the closer you get, the better they get. And I think the same applies to websites. What he was saying this is a guy who was in his 60s and had been an East End tailor for the best part of his life. And he'd made shirts from everyone, all the famous people in the world. And he refused point blank to ever make a white shirt. Doesn't matter who asked him. Ronald Reagan asked him and he said no. He didn't care. Because he had his own design ethic that he put into this. And he just had a weird thing about white shirts. What he's trying to say here, I think, applies directly to web design. I think the best websites are the ones that look good at a glance, that have impact, that capture you, that delight you. But actually, the closer you get, the better they get too. So although I started this talk talking about neuroscience, that if there's any takeaways from it at all, the takeaways would be that by understanding how our brain works and that we have these immediate emotional reactions, everyone has them, they can't control them, we can accommodate that and perhaps understand it. And also we can maybe be a bit more forgiving when people give us really crappy critique based on this initial gut reaction they have. But actually as designers, that's when we explain it to clients, that's one thing to talk about. And the other thing to talk about is utility over the long term. And how sites become friends of ours. We can love them at first glance, just like a marriage. You can fall in love at first glance and be delighted and enthralled by the sight of this person. But actually, over time, the relationship changes and actually can be even better. And you end up with a friend as well as someone you just admired at first glance. And that's it. Thank you very much. Thank you.